Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here on this bright, sunny Monday morning. We have four bills for public hearing with possible work sessions and two that were in work session mode. We're waiting for some paperwork, so we're not sure we're going to be able to get through them all or not. I believe we're going to start with 2964A. So let me open a public hearing on that one. Chana?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, 2964A comes to you from Representative Barton. This deals with a conservator in a court proceeding representing a child. Now, a guardian ad litem is appointed by a court to represent the best interests of a child in a court proceeding. A conservator is a person who's appointed by the court to manage the property and affairs of another, including a child. Both a guardian ad litem and a conservator may appear on behalf of a child in an action, but only the guardian ad litem currently may bring a request for injury-related medical expenses within the larger claim. House Bill 2964 allows a conservator to file the same paperwork that the guardian ad litem is currently allowed to do. There is no fiscal, no revenue, and no amendment.
All right, and we have Representative Barton. Sir, please come forward.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent Oregon House District 40, and I'm here today on a bill. I can't say that it's of great moral importance or political importance to the people of Oregon or to me. It's a pretty obscure bill. But it is, I suppose, to the contrary. It is so obscure and such a clarification of a technical statute that I figured nobody else would sign up to testify in favor of it, and I better come over here in case there are any questions. So before I launch into a lengthy testimony, Mr. Chair, I should ask if that would be welcome. If counsel's explanation is satisfactory to the chair and the committee, I'm happy to return to the Business and Labor Committee. But if there are any questions or if you'd like me to explain it, I'd be happy to do so.
Folks, we have an opportunity here. A good representative ask us if we want his assistance in knowing more. Senator Thatcher will start off.
You know what? I really appreciate your ability to translate from legislative council speak to English.
Chair, I'll very well. With that invitation, I will do my best to explain it, Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher. I think council, as always, did a very good job, actually, and I'm afraid that my explanation might set us back, but let me try. There is a statute, it's ORS 31.700, that's pretty obscure. I estimate, without knowing at all, but I estimate maybe it's invoked a dozen times or so a year. It has to do with if a child is injured and then has subsequent injury litigation. It lets the medical expenses for that child between the ages of 0 to 18, which technically belong to the parent, that claim. It lets the court basically streamline it so this can be done in one case, i.e. just the child. There aren't two parties to the case, if that makes sense. That's the statute that this affects. Now, generally speaking, conservatorships, which is something this committee runs into a lot, conservatorship is an extraordinary authority. It could apply to children. It could apply to, for example, people with severe mental illness. It often is used in this committee. It comes up in the context of the elderly. That's like, imagine the authority of a conservator is this giant circle. A guardian ad litem is pretty obscure. It's just, yeah.
We deal with a lot of elderly issues. Is that something just, wondering if that.
What did I say, Mr. Chair?
Oh, it sounded like
did I misspeak?
You said that in the sense of conservatorship that we probably are familiar with that in dealing with elderly.
That's where it comes up most commonly, is it, in this committee, does it not?
I didn't know if you were just referring to any of us.
It's too early. Monday morning, Mr. Chair, Monday morning. To make a long story short, this statute, it is very odd that a guardian ad litem would have authority that a conservatorship would not. Conservatorship is a much broader authority, and this clarifies that the statute extends to both guardian ad litem and conservators. Again, I think I might have set us back there. I'm sorry, Senator Thatcher.
I'm good with that.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for the good representative.
Sure. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. Representative, would this apply if the individual was injured perhaps by the claws of a cat?
Oh, Senator Gelser. It's Monday morning. Yeah, apologies for that, Mr. Chair and Senator Gelser. To the extent your inbox is filled with decline bills, I don't know if anyone else has got that. That's my fault. I'm sorry about that. I didn't know. But yes, Senator, this would apply to those injuries if necessary.
Thank you very much.
What? Yeah. Thank you, Senator.
I don't know how to start off a Monday morning, I can say. All right, any other questions for the good representative? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Kuczynski.
Let me ask if there's anyone else who would like to testify today on House Bill 2964A, please rush forward. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. And we're ready on this one, aren't we?
Correct.
So we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2964A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2964A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2964A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Gelser, will you be your carrier, please?
I would be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you. Please remember the declawing as an example.
I will.
All right. So we'll close the work session on 2964A. And we're going to go back up to the top and start off with another public hearing on House Bill 2208A.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, 2208A comes to you from Representative McEwen. This measure allows a public code enforcement officer, such as a public code inspector, a building inspector, to request that personal information become exempt from public record disclosures unless the public interest requires disclosure. It allows the officer that requested the records kept by the Department of Transportation to show the address of the officer's employing agency and not the home address of the officer. You have today the Dash A2 amendments, which provide an absolute exemption to personal information of individuals certified or licensed by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training as maintained by the department. It would include current and past licensees or certificate holders, and the information exempted includes the residential address, telephone number, personal cellular numbers, emails, driver's license, etc. Declares emergency effective on passage. We are still waiting for the fiscal on the A2 amendments.
All right, thank you. So I have two people that are currently signed up, Jack Dempsey, Michael Savaggio. Want you to please come forward. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to testify on any part of 2208A? Gentlemen, who would like to start?
I will, Senator. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey, representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, here to testify on the Dash A2 amendment. As counsel explained, towards the end of the amendment on page 13, it adds a new exemption to public records for address, telephone number, email address, date of birth, Social Security number of individuals currently or previously certified or licensed by the Department of Public Standards and Training contained in the records maintained by the department. It also adds Section 6, which is an emergency clause. If you look back to page 1 of the amendment, which is current statute, Section 5, Sub 3 says that a public body employee or volunteer addresses Social Security numbers, date of birth, telephone numbers contained in personnel records maintained by the public body that is the employer or the recipient of volunteer services. Based on a recent AG opinion, looking at DPSST, DPSST is not the employer of the folks that they license and certify. Therefore, their information is exposed right now to statute. Recent AG opinion says regarding date of birth, that we do not believe that an ordinary reasonable person would find disclosure of dates of birth to be highly offensive, essentially allowing that release just for date of birth. But it also continues to say that the statute does not categorically exempt even officer addresses or phone numbers from disclosure. That's a limited exemption based on a specific request from the officer. We feel like common sense would tell us that that information should be protected information for our public safety officers. even something along the lines of the date of birth in today's society of massive, you know, online information can lead to disclosure of other personal information, such as their address, where their children go to school, that type of thing. And I don't think I need to explain to this committee that the folks that our public safety officers and corrections officers deal with on a regular basis, why we need to exempt that information. So I would ask this committee to adopt the Dash A2 amendments and pass this on. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. This amendment is very important to our membership. As my colleague just noted, the privacy of officers' dates of birth, other personally identifiable information is something that we feel very, very strongly needs to be especially protected. The this issue is a question of whether the legislature wants to make a statement that dates of birth should be public records freely available on these officers, or whether they should be protected. I believe that that statement has been made already, and what we're doing is we are closing a loophole. If a request were to be made to a specific police agency, for example, it would be, I think everyone agrees that that would be able to be turned down given subsection 3 of the section we're addressing. This is a artifact that was not brought to our attention until recently, that someone could make a request to DPSST as a licensing agency. So we're just asking for that to be closed. You may understand that dates of birth are generally considered public records through the state's voter records. I want to point out that there is a specific context that we're concerned about, and that is the context of linking a date of birth to a specific police officer. If I were to go into the voter file and search for, you know, Bob Smith, for example, that's not a real person, I would find many, many Bob Smiths. If I had a date of birth to attach to that record, I would be able to pull a specific Bob Smith's address, members of household, etc. So this is something that we're asking for protection in context. Similarly, just to give you an example, one of the other protections in the public records law is answer keys to academic exams. So, for example, if I was a student taking a test, I could not make a information request to my professor for the answer key, even though all of those answers might be otherwise publicly available to me if I did the research. So what we're asking for is a very specific, very narrow closing of a loophole in one specific context. And we urge your support.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Burdick.
Thank you. So if you were to make a request for Portland Police, for example, for information, they don't release date of birth for the agencies?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, if there was a request made to the an actual police department for an officer's date of birth, that would be covered under the existing subsection 3 of 192.502, whereby the agency could turn that down based on the personal information of their employee, but which specifically includes dates of birth, telephone, social security number. The loophole here is, of course, that DPSST, while maintaining similar records, is not the employer of the officer in question.
So, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, it's my understanding that this doesn't protect any more information than is already protected under the existing statute for agencies. Is that correct? Or are there other forms of information that are added? I guess that was what I was trying to get at.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is not a carbon copy of subsection 3, but it includes information that is otherwise protected in various other contexts. So, for example, we have a protection for personal email addresses, which I believe is covered under subsection 40. We have an exception for I believe
Mr. Chair, maybe I can just shorten this. I'm just trying to make sure that we weren't adding information that could be obtained from a police agency, but not from DPSST.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Yeah, Senator Przanski, Senator Burdick. The only one that we're adding here that I haven't been able to reference back to is emergency contact information. And obviously for most folks, that would probably be a family member. So I'm not exactly it wouldn't exclusively be a family member, so it wouldn't link back.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, we have a subsection 2 in 192.502, which generally exempts a class of information of a personal nature. The Attorney General's statement that we referred to earlier maintains that there is a broad swath of information that would not ordinarily be disclosable, such as highly personal information that would be, I think that they use the term offensive to release. That statement noted that date of birth was specifically not because that's generally available in office settings, such as, you know, oh, it's Joe's birthday, we're going to have a birthday cake or whatever. In this case, I would say that it is our position that things like emergency contact information would absolutely be items of a personal nature that were already covered by subsection 2.
All right. Any other questions? Jack, I'd like for you to please submit a copy of the AG opinion.
Be happy to.
I'll just put on the record, I disagree with that opinion as to identification such as a birthday in this day and time, knowing cross-check for ID purposes and for identity theft. I hope that we can relook at that issue. I personally think that we should actually look at this on a much broader area than just public safety and first responders, knowing that ID theft is as high as it is, and knowing that one of the markers is, in fact, date of birth. So that's my statement. Any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you very much. I didn't see anyone else who wanted to come forward. I'll ask one more time on House Bill 2208A. Amy, come on up.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I had not seen the A amendments yet, and since this touches some DMV procedures and there's now an emergency clause, as I understand it, I just wanted to put on the record that we'd like the opportunity to review it and express any concerns. I absolutely do not expect any concerns, but just wanted to put that on the record so the committee was aware.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I don't think you'll see any based on my review of this. This is really directed to DPSST and their records, not anyone else. You're already covered, and in the sense of if an officer has chosen to use the office address and all that, that's already in the system, and this is just closing, as they said, a loophole for records that are outside of the norm that's kept by a licensing agency. And I think that's another point for us, is that we do need to keep in mind that there are, besides the employer licensing arms, that in fact could keep these same personal records. That would be another way for people to be able to get in. So
thank you, Chair.
Any other individuals? Not seeing any, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2208A. We do not have the paperwork on this at this point on the A2, so we will get this set. How do you want to do it?
We can roll it till tomorrow. We'll probably have it by then, but if you wanted to be safe, we'll repost it for next week.
We'll just repost. I don't think it's that imperative that we do it by tomorrow, and that way we just make certain we don't get bottled up with requests coming out of fiscal or revenue that just haven't been able to get through because of their workload. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is going to be on House Bill 2383.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2383 comes to you from the Attorney General. Currently, individuals or companies who solicit certain sales by telephone are required to register with the Department of Justice and provide some very specific disclosures during the phone call. This expands the telephone solicitor registration requirements to include those who solicit business opportunities via telephone. This could include an outlet for selling a purchaser's goods or services on the internet or buying back goods and services such as stuffing envelopes. There is no amendment, no revenue, no fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. I have three individuals that have signed up. Cheryl, why don't you go ahead and come forward? Jean McDonald and Janet Broth. Borth, excuse me. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. Here today in support of House Bill 2383. So this is basically another consumer protection law. As you know, the Attorney General is in charge of enforcing the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And occasionally we'll see a pattern or practice of behavior out there that we think we can maybe have some more tools for some smarter enforcement. With me today to kind of explain what we're doing here is Janet Borth, an Assistant Attorney General, who is in our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection section, and Jean McDonald, who was one of the consumers who alerted us to this, to a bad actor out there. So a quick overview of just the pattern of the scam we saw here. This is a scam that can really spiral into a lot larger problems. Usually starts off something like a banner ad or something else that says, you know, did you want to make $5,000 more a month, which is particularly attractive to those maybe on a fixed income or that kind of thing. And what these folks are really looking for is to get a phone number. And basically then they start conversing, start selling basically worthless products. Sometimes it's a website that's the same as hundreds of other websites. They sell leads or coaching or that kind of thing for this person to start their own business. It's particularly dangerous because what these companies will do, somebody will pay maybe thousands of dollars into this, and they say, hey, you know what, it's not working, I'm going to pull out, and all of a sudden these scammers will send maybe a check for $50 or $100 to say, hey, guess what, it's working. So this can spiral into more, leads and so forth that they're trying to sell. The worst is when they use a consumer's good name and they start encouraging the folks to take out loans or start using their good credit. Basically, then their names are sold as part of a list of folks who are, have good credit and are maybe have a listening ear, and those names will get sold down the chain for other sorts of things. So that's the problem. Our solution here is basically to stop things before they start going down that spiral and require registration up front. And this allows our investigators on the ground to send a notice right out at the front saying, hey, we see you're doing this, you're not registered, please register. And usually with a lot of these scam artists, that will just mean they leave the state. And if they are legitimate, then they can register and we can keep an eye on any bad practices. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jean, and she's going to kind of share her story of the bad actor she alerted for us.
Good morning.
Yeah, in my situation, like all...
Jean, I need you to put your name on the record, please.
Jean Elizabeth McDonald.
Thank you.
And I live here in Salem. And like many other seniors, I'm short of funds, looking for a way to make a few extra dollars. And I had got involved with someone before this one and had lost $5,000. In fact, they first time I even tried to contact them, they didn't exist. They were gone. And never had any contact with them whatsoever. But when this one came along, and I think this is where they got my number, probably from the previous one, and called and said that they had an offer and that I could make some good money and that this was strictly a legitimate business and that what they were offering was a credit card processing service for small businesses. And the thing that by now I was a little bit cautious because of what had previously happened. So I was asking a lot of questions, and I specifically asked them where they were, who they were, exactly what they're doing. And their answer was that they were affiliated with the Aflac, the well-known insurance company, and that, yes, this was a legitimate business, And Aflac would never allow anything to come about that wasn't up front. And so the man that originally contacted me was Michael Casey, and he was a real good talker. And he told me all the things I could do with this, and I was supposed to make some good money and all that. And he would coach me all the way through it. And the fact that I didn't, that wasn't really computer, up on computers, that I didn't have to do any of the work myself, that they would work the process for me, and that they would have a regular income off from it. And so after all this, I put some money into it. And I could keep contacting him, and he contacted me on a regular basis. And everything seemed to be going along all right. And, of course, he talked me into putting extra money into it, which I did. And like she said, I was getting some funds back. It wasn't much, but I was getting, like, the first time I got $111, and then the next time I got $119, and then I got $321, which sounds like, well, maybe this thing is going somewhere. And so I went along with it and actually put some more money into it, and they had another offer that was supposed to even be greater. And then other people started making contact with me, other companies making contact. It was all supposed to be part of the same outfit, but it was under a different name. One was process planning, another was business success, and then didn't even come down to a tax club. I keep saying that now that I was this far along, I needed more things and more things put in line. And then I needed an LLC and things like that. So this kept going along. But after about 3 months, then all of a sudden, I couldn't, wasn't making contact with the man that was supposed to be my coach through all this thing. Every time I'd call him, he wasn't there. There was always some excuse. And then he'd turn me over to a secretary or somebody else that was supposed to check, how come my checks weren't coming through anymore? And pretty soon, just excuse after excuse after excuse. And by that time, realized that there was something wrong, but I didn't know what to do about it. So, but somebody in Florida got a hold of my number and called me and said they knew that I had gotten involved with the Aflac Assist and that they knew that it was a fraud and that they would help me out to get out of it for a certain amount of money, cash money up front. And anyway, and they had my whole information. I mean, they knew everything about me. They had I'd used 3 credit cards. And they had the full number, all 3 of those credit cards. Not just the ending number, they had the whole thing. And fortunately for me, one of the guys decided to try to use that credit card and run up some accounts, small accounts, I think it was less than $300 total or something like that. But that's when I made contact. Somebody suggested I call the police department, and the police department was the one that told me to go to the Department of Justice. That's how I got in contact with Pat's, I forgot her last name, CJ. Anyway, she took me on, and fortunately for me, she got all my money back. I was returned everything except, of course, I didn't get my interest and all that back, but I got everything else back. Thank God.
Well, it's nice that it worked out for you.
Yes.
And thank you very much for being willing to come forward and express what happened to you so we can hopefully help others. So, questions? Jean, I'm assuming you're just here as necessary, or Janet, excuse me.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you all very much. This is ready to go, I believe. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing and open up work session on House Bill 2383.
Chairman, House Bill 2383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2383 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So order. Senator Thatcher, will you be our carrier on this one?
Sure.
Senator Thatcher will be our carrier. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the work session. And we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on House Bill 2911.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, House Bill 2911 is the product of a bill you passed in 2014, which would be House Bill 4133. It directed Legislative Council and the Department of Justice to review Oregon statutes to identify outdated, obsolete, or duplicative statutes. As a result, there were four different measures introduced this session. House Bill 2911 is the proposed cleanup to court-related language. There's no fiscal, no revenue. It's ready to go.
All right. Thank you. Ted, thank you.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Ted Reutlinger with Legislative Council. Your council has described how this bill got to you. It came from House Bill 4133, which was adopted in 2014. And with this particular bill, Legislative Council and the Department of Justice worked with the Oregon Judicial Department to identify laws relating to courts that would fit the goal of House Bill 4133, which was to repeal and amend obsolete and outdated and duplicative laws. In working with the Judicial Department, these are the laws that everybody agreed on and that made it into the bill. They're very basic things that do away with provisions of law that are generally obsolete and outdated. They're non-controversial. The Department of Justice, Legislative Council, and the Judicial Department all agree on that particular point. And I'm happy to try and answer any questions that you might have.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Ted? Ted, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2111? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing, open the work session on House Bill 2911.
Chairman of House Bill 2911, the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2911 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Burdick, will you be our carrier on 2911?
Be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on 2911. And let me see before I open up work sessions, have we got the paperwork yet?
2549, we do not.
All right, so we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2908A.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, 2908A, we heard last week on the 12th, brings Oregon law into compliance with the Federal Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act of 2015. We have the A2 amendments back. There is a minimal impact and no revenue impact. We had a question about a bill in another committee, House Bill 2890, which uses some very similar language and deals with age-appropriate and developmental-appropriate activities and extracurricular activities. In reviewing the two bills, they're very similar language, very close. They're not exact. I believe that there may be a conflict amendment or an ad enrolling. They're going to mesh these. I think they're okay to go together because the language is very, very similar but not exact. They deal with a similar subject matter. They deal with the same terminology, but they're not exactly the same words.
So let me ask, the status on the other bill is?
Awaiting a work session, I believe, 2890.
And do we want to get any clarification from LC before we actually move this one?
LC came back with it was fine to go.
Okay. All right, we've got a work session open on 2908A. Senator Cruz?
I move that dash A2 amendment into House Bill 2908.
Senator Cruz moves the A2 amendment into House Bill 2908. Discussion.
Just to clarify, that doesn't make any substantive changes. That is just a technical fix. Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Any objections? Not any, so ordered.
The chair move House Bill 2908A as amended by the dash A2 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2908A as amended by the A2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz will carry our House Bill 2908A, and that will close us the work session on that. And so I will, at this point, we're waiting for the paperwork. We're going to schedule the work session for 2208A once we get that. And I'm assuming 2549 still hasn't come in.
That's not. We have several people who are here at your request. We wanted to just hear from those folks.
Okay.
They have not signed up to testify because it wasn't a public hearing.
Right. So, and?
DAS and Revenue and PERS.
Okay. So it sounds like we have a few agencies that are represented here regarding House Bill 2549. Is that correct? So what I'm going to do is go ahead and open up a work session, since that's what we got scheduled, for the purpose of taking invited testimony. And I understand there may be three individuals or agencies that are here that wanted to make testimony or give some type of testimony.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Senior Policy Advisor at PERS. We listened to your last public hearing on this bill and understood that you had some questions about the collections process that the daughter of the constituent from Representative Greenlick was going through. So I'll describe the process very briefly to you. In 1999, the PERS board overcredited PERS member accounts with 20% earnings rather than 11.33% earnings as later determined appropriate by the courts. Again, that was 1999. The city of Eugene filed a lawsuit against PERS, and we subsequently had to go through all of those court procedures. We do have PERS statutes that require us to collect overpayments from member accounts, and it was ultimately decided again that we had to go back and collect those overpayments from the accounts. That took a while to process, again, with those court proceedings and determinations of what we had to do. We gave notice to all of the members, whether existing accounts or those people who are already receiving benefits or those people who died in the interim, that we had to collect on. So in 2006 through 2009, we were communicating with all of those people that we needed to collect on, that we were going through that process. But court proceedings stopped, started. So over a long period of time, we were giving notice to our members and then attempting to make collections. The collections process that Ms. Gulish's mother participated in, it was a part of the whole collections process where we were working with 29,000 benefit recipients to collect $156 million. So I do have Paul Brown here, who is head of that Strunke Jean collections process, and he can explain a little bit about the communications that we have with our members, our attempt to collect on those accounts, and then ultimately how Ms. Gulish's mother's estate was attempted to collect on. We attempted to collect on that estate.
Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, committee members, my name is Paul Brown. I was the project manager for the Strunke Jean recovery effort. Again, we went through a process of 29,000 recipients that we had a court mandate to recover funds that were overpaid to them. At the time we initiated the process, we were given an order from the courts again for a appeal process that had begun, and we were given a cease and desist from the initial process that we had started back in 2006, I believe. That process lasted a number of years for the appeals to work its way through the process, and in 2012 we were given the go ahead to from the courts to resume those collection processes. At that time, we were given a much limited staff and budget availability for us to reinitiate those processes. The initial process had several people involved. We had a pretty large staff that was working on that. A great deal of that process was getting the math and making sure everyone, the recalculations were correct on the overpayments. I'm sure you can imagine with the number of options for retirement that are available, that those mathematics and the arithmetic to get everyone back in line with the right payment at the right time for the right member is a pretty monumental job. So when we were given the initial cease and desist for the original collection process, we continued to do the math at that point. The math was completed over a period of time, even though we knew we had a possibility that we weren't going to go back and collect those funds. At the time the court order came down, we were given the go-ahead. We had the math already done, so it was a matter of just initiating the final collection process, which we did in 2012. That process, again, due to budget limitations and staff limitations, was a very limited amount for us to be able to initiate. So it involved us essentially sending out a notification. Anyone who was receiving a benefit at that time was notified that we would do an offset over a period of time. If they wanted to increase that offset, they could do so. We had several people who did take that up on it, that offer, and increased it so they could pay it off sooner. We had people who contacted us and immediately paid it off because they wanted to be done with it. Anyone who did not contact us back at that point or for whatever reason wasn't able to initiate a repayment plan because we didn't have the expertise in-house and we didn't have the staff, we were immediately forwarded then to the Department of Revenue for collections. I think that's where we ended up today.
So again, we had members, benefit recipients who were living and dying through this whole collections process. And unfortunately, there were times where we would give notice of collections to somebody living and subsequently they would die. We would have to communicate with the estate about the over collections and then be notified either at the Department of Revenue or then subsequent private collections that the estate, the person we're trying to collect on is deceased, and then we would need to receive notification that the estate is closed, has gone to probate, closed. So 2549 gives very clear direction that in the event we're in a similar situation in the future, that if we receive official notification from the estate that, in fact, it is closed, we no longer have to collect. We don't want to collect on a deceased person's estate. Unfortunately, sometimes that happens, especially over that long period of time and with the sheer volume of people that we are trying, benefit recipients that we're trying to collect on. We appreciate that clarity in the bill that it presents, but we would be happy to answer questions.
In addition, our demographic that we happen to be collecting from is a much different demographic than you would have for a banking portfolio, credit cards. We're dealing with a generational issue because of our demographic who is retiring out.
All right. So let me just follow up. My understanding is correspondence or contact was going on with members from what I'm hearing from 2006 forward, and of course there's litigation going on, so it's on and off. I understand that. Do you know for a fact, I guess, whether or not this particular estate or the individual prior to being deceased, I'm not sure when she died, had that type of contact from the agency?
Yes.
All right. And I guess the other part would be notice, because, I mean, that's what I'm looking at is whether or not there was notice that there was a potential claim there that should have been somehow listed in the estate as something was outstanding.
Senator Pruszynski, I can speak to that. We had an order from the courts to cease all collection process. At that time, anyone who did file a response to us to say an estate has been opened, we were unable to respond to because it would have initiated collection process. So by court order, we weren't allowed to respond to any requests for estate filings.
All right. So when, prior to this, let's say this bill passing, if the agency received notice that the individual that you're trying to collect from is deceased and that the estate is closed, from what I remember from the testimony, it seemed like there was a belief at that point, even with that information, you still needed to refer it to a collections agency for processing.
That is correct. That's in our statutes for the collection process, that we're statutorily required to turn anything, even anything that is even returned back to us from the Department of Revenue, then must still be forwarded on to collection, private collection agencies.
All right, so this will take care of that. I mean, that's the part that I forgot to add in, is that I know it went to Department of Revenue, and then they actually referred it back to the agency, mm-hmm. stating this person not only deceased, but their estate has been closed. And you felt that it was statute, not rule, that forced you to send it to a collection agency?
That is correct.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I don't think there's any reason for us to ask DAS or Department of Revenue to come forward. Hopefully this is going to take care of it. But if there's other scenarios sitting out there, these are like I call little time bombs, that is not good PR, not user-friendly. We'd like to know it so we can take care of the problem. What my understanding at this point, based on passing this law, agencies throughout the state, when they receive notice from the Department of Revenue that an estate has been closed, that will, in fact, cease and desist any attempt to collect on that, and it will just be written off. With that, Chair is fine. Is there any other comments or questions? All right. And on that one there, it looks like we are waiting for the paperwork, and I'm assuming while we're here it didn't come through. So we will get this rescheduled for work session. And thank you all very much for coming forward. So with that, we'll close the work session on 2549. I believe that takes care of the work that we have for today, knowing that 2208A and 2549 will be rescheduled for a work sessions. And that will cause us to go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you. 30. Thank you.